Hello all, I'm Steve Plume. My co-host and I, Catherine Shinnock, are both registered art therapists and licensed clinical counselors who are also creatives. In this podcast, we explore creativity, and especially that tension felt by many creative folks. It's that tension that we imagine is present between the colorful, artful kite and its stable, grounded string. And oh my goodness, here we are, season two. We're thrilled to be back after our short break. But we're still giddy when we think about how much fun season one was. We had such a great time learning about podcasting and learning through amazing conversations with creatives from all over the world and on so many different creative paths. We're glad you came along, and we hope that you're telling your friends about us, giving us good reviews on Apple Podcasts, and liking and or following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It'd also be great, too, if you search Kites and Strings on Patreon.com, where you can donate as little as $1 a month to help us keep this kite in flight. Today we speak with Dr. Kayla Coates, who is an assistant professor of art education in the School of Art at Arizona State University. She has published in a range of books and journals, including Makers, Crafters, Educators, Working for Cultural Change, and Bridging Communities Through Socially Engaged Art. Now, I could continue to list articles, research, and other accolades, as her CV is literally 9 pages long. But rather than do that, I'm just going to say we had a super fun time talking with her and learning about how she grabs her string and flies her kite through the expansion of ideas and teaching future art teachers to think beyond the idea that art education is just helping kiddos make a nice pinch pot or paint a pretty picture. So I'm going to let you know this is possibly the first time that we've interviewed somebody where when we like Google their name, we get like Google Scholar.
Yes.
I know, it's always really funny. I'm like, oh, weird. That's me.
So now I'll give sort of a backstory. I was referred to you through Denise Klein, old friend of mine from way back. And she's an art educator in Texas.
She's in North Texas. Yeah. By Dallas.
Okay. And I'm sure does wonderful work and does amazing things.
I know. Denise is magical. I know. She's like glue. Like people just attract to Denise. She was like my mentor. When I did art teacher certification, she was my mentor.
Okay.
And then when I wrote my dissertation, she was one of the three people that I researched.
And so what was your dissertation on?
I was looking at the homes of what I identified as makers. So there was Denise, an art teacher. There was a guy that owned a missile base. Like he had rehabbed a missile base. And then a woman that was a young artist slash farmer. So I was like looking at their homes as basically like narratives, like where every object was an indicator of like some element of learning and like a line through their life. Mm-hmm. And then through over the 2 years of like looking at their homes, basically like my whole life turned into Inception and like everything just folded in on each other. And then it also folded in on like the entire like history of America. And it was like somehow it was like farming, military, education, like all of like the big giant institutions that we live by came out of these homes. So like it started out that I was being nosy and sneaking in. Like I would drive by people's houses and I got really interested in the fact, like in underground shelters in people's backyards, and like bomb shelters. And I began to think like, whoa, you know, what would that have been like in the 50s to feel like I need to install that in my backyard? Like I definitely need the thing.
Yeah.
And then I learned that there was this missile base 5 miles from us. And that's why everybody had bomb shelters.
Okay.
So then I started creeping around the missile base and I thought it was just like closed up and grass is growing everywhere. And so I ended up like trespassing on the land. And then the owner came out and it wasn't like he had like rehabbed the space into like an artist community space. And so then I ended up meeting this young farmer and then it turns out like his best friend. It was just like all folded in. And then the first time I went to Denise's house, of course, she had a bomb shelter in her backyard. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. It was super fascinating.
going back to kind of that idea of the makers, kind of what we've been probably referred to as creatives. Like you're trying to find that thread that connects those that became makers or creators. Did you ever find that thread?
I'm still sort of thinking about that thread, because growing up, my grandpa did construction. My mom did, you know, kind of makeshift everything. Like the way they would say it is like buy a bucket of chicken and a 12 pack of beer and most people will come help you out, you know? So like every weekend growing up was like relative's house doing some kind of construction or some kind of something like that. I mean, that for me sparked to me this sort of sense that you can do, like, of just being interested in trying. And if it's jacked, you know, then you can hire somebody to do it. But like sweat equity is kind of like a lot cheaper. For me, it was like, what are other people's origin story? That was really what I wanted to know. What got you here? What interests you? What keeps you interested? And then hearing those stories, and then inevitably their homes told that story as well. Just like asking questions about what is around people generates these really fascinating through lines. Back to your question, I mean, I think it's a sense of curiosity. I think it's a willingness to fail, or like not caring about failing, you know, not being like beholden to perfection or whatever. I mean, there's something kind of sincere in like seeing the potential of just kind of whatever's around you.
And kind of looking at stuff and just thinking that you can do it. I mean, I've always thought about like the way I do home remodeling. I'm a scary combination of cheap, stupid, and confident.
Right. And then we'll figure it out. You know, dissertation started with questions of DIY. And I was really into like skater punk culture growing up. 70s DIY as a little kid, and then like 80s, 90s punk culture. And then that just kind of moved into continually following those threads. You know, I've had friends that actually identify as artists. And whenever I hear DIY, I just think shitty.
Makers, creators, a rose by any other name. Interesting stuff, and it makes me want to read Kayla's dissertation. But now we're going to explore Kayla's own creative process. I love the sense of wonder and exploration she will espouse, as I see it as so important for teachers to embrace, especially the future art teachers that Kayla teaches. The need for structure pops up, as it has in many of the talks we've had, but with a bit of a different flair.
How does this show up for you, Kayla? Like, as you were working on this and like really like exploring people's homes and their environments and how this creates the narrative of who they are, were you finding yourself doing that about yourself and being like, oh, look, here's this like random thing that I got wherever, and like just kind of pulling those pieces together?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. You know, like you go through phases of life. Like if you look back on them, you're like, oh, God, like this phase was really generative. And it was usually like the people you're around.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there'll be periods where like they're just lull. Like, you know, and you realize like there's nothing really kind of that you're like passionate about at the moment.
Yeah.
And that was what I began to realize as looking at their lives, was kind of reflecting on my life. And like, I'm much more nomadic than the people I was studying. You have to kind of let things go.
Yeah,
so there wasn't as much to mine in my own life, because I kept kind of like purging to move to the next place. I think when you're thinking with like what matters in life, everything around you starts to like resonate in a different way, or like a bit a different kind of energy. So I definitely found like during that whole phase, I was just kind of alive to the world around me in a much different way, like a much more excited kind of way. And so I don't identify as like a painter or a sculptor or like any definitive thing. It's much more like I'm interested in ideas. And I see concepts as the things that connect up the world.
So what's so interesting, I was looking at your like CV this morning, and my question was, here's this woman who does like all this stuff with like art. She's a like art history teacher. And I was so curious to see how you were, because I'm like, I don't know what half these words mean. And so my question was, oh, I wonder if she makes, and like, is there artistry, is there creativity in academic writing? And landed in this place of, it's the thoughts you're going to explore. And so just hearing you say that, I was like, yes, she's a creative like thinker. And maybe you make stuff too, but like the creativity is coming up in thinking and thinking about new perspectives on thinking and exploring and understanding. Is that like how you would identify or describe yourself?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm much more interested in the ways in which any kind of making builds connections than I am like the product outcome, you know, like that's cool. Like that's kind of like a little artifact or whatever, but I'm much more interested in like where thought takes you. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's thinking through making something, or maybe that's thinking through walking. But I'm much more interested in like where that goes than I am like, look at the beautiful thing that I'm going to refine and make it shiny. So like, that's really beneficial. Like I teach art teachers. I find that's more useful for kind of tapping into each of them as individuals than me being like, I'm a painter. That is what I am. That is like this kind of closed identity of like, that is my thing. Cause I can like link up with their thing. Like, I hear what you're saying. Let's go down that path, or let's go down that path. You know what I mean?
So it's thinking, connecting, and moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people might jump into their paint. Some people might jump into their clay. You jump into letting that thought grow, and probably from there jumping into books and building it and researching it, and until you come up with a more sculpted idea or.
Well, I think it's also sort of being like alert to what's about to happen. Like, so for instance, I'll give you an example. One of my favorite experiences was some students of mine, they were going to do a clay project. So I was like, well, let's just go dig the clay and then process it ourselves and see. I had no idea how to do that. And I was like, we'll just figure out how to do it as we do it. This is why I was living in East Texas at that time. I was like, somebody figure out where we could dig clay. They met a lady, and the lady's like, yeah, I got like 40 acres. So yeah, come on out. And so we take our field trip out. She's like, yeah, let's go take a walk around the land. And she's like, well, you could dig here, but let's go a little bit further. And she's like, there's this whole patch down here. And she's like, see how it's all different? And it was like the grass changed dramatically. And there's this like strip. And it turned out that like 10 years earlier, the state had taken the land and put in a pipe, like an oil pipeline. And it completely changed the ecology to like new birds came to that strip because it was an entirely different clay that had been displaced and put on top. Mm-hmm. Four totally different clay bodies is what you call like different kinds of clay because the state had laid this pipeline. And I'm like my students are like, oh, neat. One's gray and one's red. And I'm like, do you understand what is happening right now? Like, we just learned about like the state and like they can take land and then oil and like birds. Getting the clay led us to doing all these other really amazing things. And so then in like the next 2 months of trying to process this clay, which takes 9,000 years, I was also like, look at all the stuff that's in clay. Like, it was just fascinating. So that's the kind of stuff that I get really excited about. Like the clay pieces, I did not, they all fell apart, but it was like the process of digging and learning so many elements through that experience was far more valuable to me than the making a nice pot or something, you know?
You saw all these connections. How old were the people that you were taking out there?
Like college age, you know, like 19 to 24 or whatever.
Still not there. They're thinking, okay, this is a cool field trip. And some of them may have connected and maybe got into that and thought about all these different connections, fireworks going off in your head.
Well, and I think that comes back to those same childhood roots where it's like, if you figure out how something works, then you can manipulate it to do whatever you want. Right. So like a lot of that was like, what would it mean to go do that ourselves and go dig it rather than buying a processed clay bag that's ready to go. And it would be a much more successful pot, but you know, doing that, you're doing all those steps yourself. Now that can go 1,000 different directions.
There's two things I hear in how you're thinking and approaching that are really, really interesting to me. One is the deconstruction. So I'm thinking about the, like, you take a toaster and you pull it apart to understand how a toaster works. You did that with clay in that particular example. But then in doing the deconstruction, what I heard your creative brain does is it expands out, like thinking about the birds and the ecosystem and the government and the pipeline and all of these things, where I think a lot of times when people are creating, they're refining rather than expanding. And I guess that leaves me wondering, have you ever reached a point where you're like, my mind can't grow this anymore? If I think any bigger, I'm beyond myself and I'm going to go crazy. Like, and my reality inception is upside down and I don't know. So like, where does it stop?
Well, I mean, that's a really important question. And one, like, to be productive in like terms of the way are forced to be productive, you do have to stop. You do have to be able to like put a period and like finish the sentence. You could call it like squirreling and just like, oh, new thing can make you never, ever finish anything. Mm-hmm. So I do struggle with that. Close the book, finish the paper, like stop. That can happen next week, but right now you got to get this done, you know? But then also I love those moments because it's not always happening, right? You just kind of get in your habits and you're kind of like stuck in a rut and just getting through the day all the time. So like, I love those experiences where the world is just kind of on fire, are so exciting. Cause then it's like, where can we go with all of that? But it definitely stops. And I, you know, I have two kids and I have a, you know, I do all the life things. And so it's kind of easy to get in, like, where do we have to be next life too?
So is it your like life and other responsibilities that's like, put the period on it, Kayla? Or is it, it's something in your thinking, your sense of overwhelm with thoughts, or like, you're just kind of like, you're creating your own boundary here.
I'm do a lot better if people create boundaries for me.
Okay.
You know, when I was younger, I was like, I'll never get married. I'll never have kids. I'm just going to travel forever and live on a couch or whatever. And having children made me a lot more like healthy. You know, just like something to hold me accountable. Yeah. Like you kind of need that.
And you're writing an article or you're writing a chapter or something to that effect. It can't be so unwieldy that it just keeps going. You have to have a scope. You have to have a vision. Pretty much say to yourself, okay, I think I've done it, and then put that period.
Yeah, that too is tough though, because once you kind of see the potential of a story, you know, or an idea, you begin to see, or I begin to see, I heard that that's resonating with that story. That, because it's sitting in your brain, kind of like percolating all the time. And so then it's like, all of a sudden, like the potential of the connections that, like that story is now connecting to you, to the world in a different way. So it can be challenging not to be like, I should rethink that. I should really rethink how I'm going to write that. And I see it in my students too. And I'm like, don't do it. Just stick with the first story. Just stick with it. Finish it, write it, close the book. But yeah, I mean, I like writing a variety. Like I dig doing like a mixture of like things that look like academic research and then things that are shorter and more like more creative or more affective.
Yeah.
You know, that they're not about like, let me give you knowledge, but it rather like, let me help you feel what I felt, or like, let me take you into the world with me in this way.
Certainly as a professor, you're constantly generating and following different ideas and you're writing these different papers. You just have to find your different audiences for whatever you're writing at that moment.
Yeah. And I think some people get really good at a style, you know, and it's like, they're like, here's my working method. I lay this part down and then that part down, whip, whap, got it out. I'm just not that good at that. If I was doing the same style of paper all the time, I think I would get a little bit bored.
Now we're going to explore some of Kayla's less academic writings. And through this, we will hear about her experience of getting her first professor job, living in East Texas, having tattoos, and mom slacks.
My undergrad is in art education. That's where I met Denise. And I certainly want to explore some of the work that you're doing in teaching art teachers. There's certainly these very art teachery writings that you do. And then you have another one, as I'm looking at this, feeling the sting of being a tattooed mother in the public is another article that you had written.
Yeah, no, I mean, so yeah, Denise and I wrote a paper together once that I really love, like 5 years ago, she completely changed her teaching approach, like her whole curricular classroom design, everything after 20 years of teaching. It was just a really powerful transformation I watched her make. Mm-hmm. So we wrote about that together, and that was very classroom oriented. Like, what does it mean to make a change like this? And what does it mean for the students in relation to the teacher? And like, I love that. The other paper I equally love, but that one was for this book. It was called Flesh Points. And it was like learning through your body. It was like moments where your body feels something. I just moved from Denton with North Texas to this small town in East Texas. Like, it was so isolated and very deep Texas, you know, and like, 2 grocery stores in town. Like you were inevitably going to see someone you knew, God forbid you go without a bra on to the grocery store. Cause you're going to see like your students or your boss, like you're going to see someone at the grocery store. It was so humid there. It's like, and for the whole first summer, I still wore my sweater sweating my ass off to the grocery store because I just didn't know how the community would receive me with tattoos. Mm. And there was just this very antiquated sort of way of being in the world there. That was this story of me going with my kids to the grocery store and the ways in which the older women would respond to my body. Finally just said, screw it. I can't take the sweater. And like, okay, here we go. Which for most people, especially if you live in a city, they're like, what the hell? Everybody has tattoos.
Uh-huh.
But it was this place at that moment and my positionality. And so it's really just kind of a walking through a moment. My daughter's crying and like she's on my hip and like my son's running around. And it was like all these ways, the complexity of being a mother and all the stereotypes that go with certain kinds of mothers are, oh, the baby's crying. And is she trashy? Is she this? Is she that? Is she not a good mother? So it was like all these layers that I kind of felt in the grocery store for that second. So it's a totally different story, totally different kind of writing, but equally about learning and the ways in which the world speaks to us, you know.
I haven't read the article yet, but please tell me that they're like, tattoos? Pah! Why were you wearing a sweater in this hot weather?
You know, it was stupid. I mean, it wasn't really, I mean, it was a very, very, very conservative town. It was my first job.
Okay.
It was like my first like professor job. I had just like worked really hard to get this thing to be taken seriously. And then it was like living in this town where people were going to look at me and like side-eyed. And I was like, I've worked so hard. Like you have no, you know what I mean? It was this like complex thing I was going through in life at that moment too. You know, so it kind of culminates in this older woman saying, oh, bless her heart. You know, and it was just like such this sort of disingenuous shit that you do in like country towns, you know, like.
There's so much in that though, right? Like being new, wanting to prove yourself, how you adapted into that different culture. It sounds like you chose that culture because that's where you got a job. Not necessarily they're like, yes, I want to live in this like weird little like country town. So then it's like, how do you acclimate to the culture of that town while maintaining your connection to who you are? There's a lot to it. And there's something about it that I think is universal. I was talking to someone recently who was like reflecting on how much she's changed from when she finished college to now she's in her late 20s. And she's like, yeah, I mean, as soon as I graduated college and I got a job, I started dressing like I was 40 because I wanted people to take me seriously because I was so young. And like, yeah, I have to look professional. I didn't get visible tattoos until I'd been a therapist for 10 years because I'm like, well, fuck, I know I'm young. I don't want people to like write me off. And
right.
Of wanting to establish your identity as a professional, wanting to establish your identity as a mother and holding on to like who you are as like, I don't know if you were a skate punk, but you were into skate punk culture.
Right. And that's, and it's like as much even as you can rationalize in your brain, I don't care. I'm going to be me. If you know, criticize me, that's their problem. You can say that forever, but we all know like to be taken seriously, the first thing people see is your appearance. Like, yeah, now like I teach all my classes in shirts like this with all my tattoos showing. I feel enough like confidence in what I'm doing to carry it. But you know, there's certain points in life where you don't. And you're like, I'm going to look like everybody else. I'm going to wear these awkward slacks that like, like the least flattering pants in the world. You know, I think that's also just kind of maturity. Like, you know,
becoming comfortable with your own ideas and confident in your ability to be the professor that you're going to be and that you're going to be good at it, regardless of how much ink you have on your
right.
body.
And just like knowing like what you bring to the table too. Like if I come in with like the mom slacks, I feel like I'm wearing like some weird costume. Then I'm like ultra not myself. I'm like, please, I just need to go home and change, please.
This is a little like side, like tangent we're on, but I truly believe that like identity integration doesn't really happen until you're in your like mid 30s. You figure out kind of who you are-ish as a teenager. And then in your 20s, you're integrating in this whole other piece of who am I as a professional? Who am I as a parent? And then once you're in that, you're like, okay, now I know who I finally fucking know who I am. And like, I can be that.
I do think it takes some like getting there. I do think whenever I work with younger people that are like instantly, you know, that's their problem. I'm like, you know, like it also feels good to kind of earn it.
Now we're going to tap into teaching art teachers. I bit my tongue because I didn't want to sound too gripey about an approach to teaching art that I was taught back in undergrad. And that approach was partially responsible for driving me from the field. The approach seemed, in my humble opinion, to focus as much on defending art's place in the schools than really teaching art exploration. Kayla confirms that there are still worries about resources and the like, but I love the approach where the art teacher is encouraged to think and to exercise agency. To be fair, maybe those options were there for me when I was 20 and too stupid to ask questions about the college program I entered. I can also see being that stupid 23-year-old not asking useful questions when I'm interviewing and getting my first teaching job. I love that Kayla sees that it's her job to help tomorrow's teachers with those questions.
But I was going to go back to your question about working with art teachers. Yeah.
Coming up through the pipeline. Are you excited about what you're seeing?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel for them. It's a strange time. You know, I look at the jobs out there and they all look good, but I know the reality of what they're going to deal with in terms of the amount of students that are going to be in a classroom, the lack of resources they're going to have. And then there's also like so many different things happening in art education right now. Like, I feel like there's so many choices you can make as an art teacher in the ways in which you want to teach, which like any choices can be awesome or daunting, yeah. Right? Sometimes it just like, I just want two choices. I just want like two kinds of ketchup. I don't need 80 ketchups. It's too many choices. Like, I feel like that's a lot of times with the students. They're like, oh, well, wait, so what am I supposed to do? And I'm like, well, it depends on what you want to come out of it, right? Like, if you want these beautiful drawings, you're going to have your kids draw a lot. Like, people don't go to the Olympics from gym class, right? Yeah. Like, PE doesn't get you there. They got to practice and practice. And then, so some people are really into process. Some people are really into refined, beautiful drawings and really product oriented. And so these are a lot of the conversations that we have is like, what it matters to you? Like, why are you doing this? What do you want your students to feel in the classroom? What's your goal?
It's really interesting because I'm thinking about that and how different that is in just thought process as a teacher, right? Like, if I'm teaching math, there's someone somewhere that said, this is what you teach in like second, third, fourth, fifth grade on. It's so clear. And to be a teacher where I have the option to think, am I concerned about the product my students are creating? Am I concerned about their engagement with the process of creation? I feel the dauntingness of it.
And you can do both, right? But you've got to figure out how to find that balance and then like tap into what you're, you know, really read each student and what is their strength. I get so excited to see their potential and see the lessons they want to do and see what their interests are. I totally agree with you, Kath. And like, think about that all the time with the math or the science and like, this week we're doing chapter 3, sort of linear and like, you know, in third grade, you must teach this. And it's very different for art.
My question is, and this is maybe just cynical, the world sucks, but is that a question the teacher gets to answer? Or is that a question the school board and the principal answers?
It varies by district. Like some districts, like the district that I grew up in near Dallas, their like arts coordinator wants every teacher at every high, like if you're teaching high school art one, every art one teacher across Plano should be teaching the same thing every week in case a student moves from one school to the other. I'm like, whoa, that's fascinating. Like, how do they do that?
Yeah.
So some are really rigid. Others, like Denise has got, you know, a stellar kind of reputation with her administration. So she can kind of do whatever the hell she wants. So some schools or districts are like all into one thing also, like maybe they're really into their art shows, whereas others are really into like choice-based kind of play and tinkering kind of stuff. Not as much about having like a finished beautiful piece for the art show.
I could imagine from there thinking, okay, what states, what types of communities would have this type of district or this type of district? And how is it that those came about?
Yeah. I mean, I lived in Chicago for a long time, and there you find the permission to ask really hard questions. It's kind of in the blood that you could, or like in the water or whatever, that you can question authority, you know, ask tough questions. Here in Arizona, you gotta be careful, you know, like, and I always tell my students, I'm like, you know, like the other day I had a student, he was like, so, you know, how do we start difficult questions? And I'm like, well, that really depends on your population. Because when you're talking to kids, you're ultimately talking to their parents half the time, too, because they're going to go home and misrepresent whatever it was you said. So you just have to be careful. He's like, well, how do we start a conversation about white supremacy? I'm like, oof.
I love that kid. I love that student. Yeah. That depends where you live, friend.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, that's a longer conversation. But, you know, in Chicago, you can use that language and have those conversations in a much easier than you can in deep East Texas or even here in Phoenix, just because it's such a conservative culture. And, you know, it's like, you're indoctrinating my children. Regions are so different. And I don't think people realize that as much. But with something like art, where it's so personal, you know, there's just a totally different set of conversations than the science class where there's one right answer, you know?
I love that you're teaching art teachers and that you have this future art teacher asking this question about how do you venture into these discussions about white supremacy. If you ask most people about what you think future art teacher questions are, that's not what they're going to come up with.
Yeah. I've had so many people ask me that. They'll say, what does that have to do with art education? Every time I'm like, well, so what do you think art education is? You know, and then they're like, oh, I don't know. People think you're just making crafts or painting pretty pictures. You know, they think it's purely formal, you know?
Teaching the color wheel.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And you could, I mean, and that's what I tell my students. I'm like, you could, like, that is a choice. That's another choice, is just to stay safe, toe the modernist line, like just stick with your principles and elements. That's not the work I think matters that much. I think meaningful work takes time, takes talk, takes thinking, you know.
It's meaningful was the word I just heard right there.
Yeah.
Perspective drawings, the one point, the two point. How meaningful is that to the seventh grader that's sitting there and doing them? I don't know. How do you help them make it meaningful?
Yeah. I mean, and you can, right? But it, like, and that's what I often will tell my students. I'm like, well, start with the conversation before we start with the technique, or do the technique for a couple of weeks. And then let's go back and say, we're not going to do the final project till we have like a long period of ideation, and then return to that technique. But like, making art that is about nothing but just practicing the technique is okay. You know, you're a craftsperson or something. Like, it's not really like, in my opinion, that's not really like art. It's not really speaking to the world. It's
importance, I think, is the conversation and making it meaningful. Technique is just the vehicle, but what you really want to figure out is like where you're going with it. So I think that's so cool.
So Denise made this shift to TAB, teaching for artistic behavior. And so at the end of each class, whichever student in the room has finished a project that day, and all the projects are different because the students are moving between different stations at their will. Like, she's not like, now we all do drawing today. It's just like, there's a printmaking studio, a drawing studio. They can go out however they want. But at the end of each class, whichever student has just recently finished something stands up in front of the class. And these are like K to fifth grade, and presenting their work and talking about each of the choices that they made. Like, what's it about? Why did they make certain choices? Why did they choose certain materials? What was their process? And it is so eloquent. I mean, it's so powerful, because just looking at the work, you're like, I don't know what that is, whatever. But when you hear them talking about it, you're like, these were such smart, thoughtful choices. And to hear a third grader talk about them making choices to communicate X or to solve X problem that was their problem, not Denise's problem. These tools are important for anything in the world these kids want to do. You know, like, maybe they'll be artists, but they could be anything. And they're learning how to stand by their choices, talk about their choices. You know, it's really, really powerful.
Damn. Where were you when I was a senior in high school? Because I probably would have been an art teacher if I heard you talk. What you're describing to me is that teaching art is so much more than, can you draw a face that looks like a face? It's like teaching thought and reflecting on yourself, depending on where you are. Because the other thing that's really jumping out at me in what you're saying, it's really highlighting how much art embodies the values of the culture in which it's created. The art that's made in that little town in Texas that's like, who is the lady with tattoos, is probably more, I'm going to make a judgment here, maybe more concerned about making pretty pictures than the school in New York City that's going to be like, we want you to like think and reflect on society and reflect on politics and like reflect on who you are.
I completely agree. Yeah. And what I try to tell my teachers is you can do the latter. you know, you can do the risky, subversive work. Even in those more conservative places, you got to figure out the rules and you got to figure out how to bend them. You got to know your community.
Mind blown. I want to do my undergraduate degree again. Now we're going to dig more into just how important it is to help kids learn to own their choices and the benefits long term. Moving forward, I think you will be able to recognize the benefits of teaching and learning in the manner that Kaler speaks about, and maybe even adjust your thinking and reactions if you find that you could be falling short in really developing confidence and big thinking, despite your best intentions in helping develop technical skills in your young artist.
One of the things I took away from art education back when in undergrad was there's almost like there's sort of been a class that says how to defend your existence. And that's going to vary from where you're existing. Talk about parallel process with the kids and how are they going to approach the big thoughts and ideas that come to them.
And it's also like own your choices. Like that's a life skill.
Yeah.
Right. Like being able to say like, I made that choice and here's why I made it. Yeah. And not just like, cause somebody told me to, or I thought that's what we were supposed to do, or I saw somebody else do it. Like owning your life is like a big life skill that a lot of people don't do anymore.
Kayla, if that existed, if people owned their choices and felt like I'm still valuable as a person, even if I make something that goes quote wrong, I would be close to out of a job as a therapist. I would love to be like irrelevant. Because so often, especially with women, more so in their 30s and 40s now, it's like we were taught to be good girls and to like do the thing we're supposed to do. Like if a teacher, I'm imagining like fifth grade me, like drawing my, like painting my landscape in art class and having my teacher ask me, well, why did I paint the tree brown and green? I would have been like, because I'm supposed to, right?
That was the example that you showed.
I did what you told me to do. Did I do good? Can I have my gold star? Thank you. So like kind of tying back to what you were saying, Steve, about like what's coming through the pipe. I am like so excited to like these little kiddos that are in like fourth or fifth grade right now, where are they going to be in 20 years? Like, and how these independent thinkers can really be shaping like our society in such a different way just by like being challenged to like own their choices.
I've been teaching on and off for about 20 years. And you know, I find that I'm becoming like the old scared one, you know, like I'm like, oh, I don't know with these college kids today, if we can talk about that, you know?
Totally, totally.
And then I've got like my fourth grade daughter who is like coming home crying because she's like, I don't understand why people discriminate against all the LGBTQ people. And I'm like, oh my God, you're 10. I'm just so proud of like these, like I do, I see like so much potential in young people. Like I mean, I definitely see some like laziness and some other shit too, but you know, like I also am just like, there's a big promise here. I'm excited about it.
Tying back into what we're talking about with what you do, the way teachers are teaching and how you as a teacher of teachers are teaching teachers to teach. Yes.
Oh my God. It's so meta. It's like my total existence. Like in the classroom, I'm constantly meta. Like, it's like, did you see what I just did? Did you see the choice I just made? I was modeling a behavior. You know?
I love it.
And are you finding that the future teachers coming in, is this something that the groundwork has already been paved? No. Idea? They're coming in thinking you're going to teach them how to teach the color wheel.
Yep.
And only
they're thinking we're going to like introduce Van Gogh, talk about heavy lines and movement and, you know, complementary red, you know, orange and blue colors. And then we're going to paint Starry Night. So it's definitely for them too. They're like, whoa, I've never thought about, because I see curriculum building as a conceptual art practice. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're like laying a stage for a performance. What do we need on stage? And, you know, that's how I see it. It's just like a set of ideas that are now going to like take life in the world. That's why, like, when they're like, well, I wanted to do a lesson on so-and-so, my first question is like, what's the goal? And then we can figure out the performance. But like, just saying like, what is it? And like, is there one way? I'm like, well, no, there's a million ways into this. What do you want to do? And that's where I think it becomes really exciting. And it's the same conversation you would have in a studio class. Like, what are you trying to communicate? And then how, what choices are we going to make to communicate that thing, to tell that story? And, you know, so it's the same form, content, conversation. When we start talking about it like that, then it really feels like we're in a studio class, but talking about ideas. And those are like super, that's my favorite conversations to have.
I'm sure it varies from one student to the next, but are you finding that a lot of them are really happy that their brain is going, wah, like they're excited about this and that it's opening up a whole new avenue that they didn't really even consider?
A lot are, and definitely not all. Like, you know, there's a lot of very, can I just get the answer? Mm-hmm. I don't really want to do all that. We're all different. And so there are a lot that are like, well, I really want to make this. I want to make pretty objects and I want to make them in this way. And I'm like, cool. That's how we would do that. You know, so some really resonate and want to like go way out and do crazy stuff. And then some want a very much more kind of traditional route. You know, I favor the first one, but
I call them blinder people, right? Just give me the answer because they want, they mm-hmm. need this safety.
You know, it's the same person as a kid that's going to ask every, you know, miss, did I do this one right? Miss, you know, like every choice they're going to make, they want you to, you know, affirm it for them and they're not going to take a risk and they're going to, you know, wad the paper up and throw it in the trash if they make a mistake. It's the same kid, but at 20. You know,
if you're living your life in this place of I'm always looking for the route of safety, like that's one way to keep yourself safe. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're just limiting your options versus someone who's like feeling I can anchor myself. I can create safety for myself no matter how unstable I feel at any point in time.
I also often ask them, like, what is the end goal here? What actually are you teaching those kids? Because they're looking to you, like you're looking to me, you're teaching them to look to you. So like, where's the threshold that like, they're going to like now leave your class and be like a creative mm-hmm. individual because you're teaching them the opposite. Like you're teaching them to be dependent on you. So where, at what point do they like unlatch from you? And now they have permission to mess up.
Are we looking end goal June when summer starts or end goal 18 when they graduate and they're off into the world? End goal, there is no end goal. It's just forever how you live your life. And I don't know. I mean, does that something that is daunting for like teachers to think, oh, I only got them for this year. What does my little piece do in that grand picture?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and I think we live in a world that's like favors discrete, small bullshit. Like, you know, like just make it to the end of the block. Like, all, like your whole life is just mm-hmm. getting to the end of the block, you know, like just finish this project.
We need that though. I mean, for some things we need that. I mean, there's a deadline for when you need to pay this bill, right? But hopefully, you know, under the bigger umbrella of life, there's other places where you can just wander.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it's about permission.
Yeah.
Like permission to wander, like permission to mess up, permission to not finish today. You know, really kind of asking yourself, like, which of these things is real and which of these is some sort of like fake, like thing that somebody made up just because they needed to finish too, you know?
Okay, now we're going to move into something that is so hard to get around in so many schools and is a struggle, I'm sure, for so many art teachers. Yep, you guessed it, grading. And we're going to develop a new appreciation for B students.
So we're talking about art education, art in a school. Schools have grading systems. How do you teach art teachers to grade student work?
It's my least favorite thing.
I'm shocked. I never would have guessed that.
Because it suggests that I can like look across 30 things and say that one's better than that one. And it probably is, but where did the one in the middle start? Mm-hmm. And like, if they started knowing nothing and they're here, the other one might've had 3 or 4 years of this.
Right.
Of course they look better. Like, but just looking at these across as if they're the same, to be like equitable, or like it's not, like these are all individual humans, you know? So what I typically ask is like, what do you care about? Because their inclination is like, I'll just make a rubric. And I'm like, well, what's on the rubric? Like, they don't like, what are you looking for? You know, mm-hmm. is it and like, I'll find that they're just like, everything's completion. And I'm like, that's really all you care about, that they finished? Like, that's like the lowest possible bar, mm-hmm. you know, at least like have them do like a reflection or talk about like something. What mattered in this project? Was it the idea? Was it craftsmanship? What was the project about? And then let's talk about that. But not everything has to be about craftsmanship.
Yeah.
So what I intend to do with my own classes is I make the project so complex that if you get through all the steps, you've already done so much work that like, like it may not be great, but you can't get to the end without having gone through a whole lot of paths.
Yeah.
That's what I try to do so that I don't have to get into these squabbles about the difference between a 98 and a 92. Cause that bugs me to know. I mean, it's like, I mean, education has just been ruined by grading.
Yeah.
Like people don't care about learning. They care about the grade.
You get so caught up on that measurement of a grade.
Well, like, yeah, like it doesn't matter if there's not a grade associated, like it's a waste of my time. And I'm just like, what the hell else do you do that with in your life? Like, you know what I mean? Like, where else does this external thing drive what you value instead of you just internally like caring about it?
Grading. It's a relatively new thing. Before that, it was just learning.
Yeah. I mean, it was like you want quality to finish, but it wasn't this like heavy, it determines everything. It determines funding. The levels of anxiety are just passed down and down from like the state to the administration, to the principal, yep. to the teachers, to the students. It's just so pervasive that this idea of like actually messing around with stuff, which is where I think creativity comes from, doesn't happen because it's like, well, if I don't do that, then I'm not going to get the good grade. Right. And it's like, who cares about the grade? Part of me wants to say like, you're all going to get an A. Now, can we actually do something?
Yeah. Yeah.
They too believe in the grade. They're like, oh, that I don't have to come. I'm like, God, what's the answer?
It's the studying for the test rather than really wanting to learn the information. And when I think about like just some people that I've worked with that are so perfectionistic, they would like short circuit if they went into a class where it was like, you already have an A, but like, what do I do then?
Yeah. Like I love B students. Like yes. B students.
Yes. Yes.
They want to know, they may like blow off a couple things because they're like, eh. But then they're going to take a risk because they're not like hung up on like what like me, like a friend of mine used to call the grade grubbers.
Yeah.
Who are like going to needle you down. Like, well, exactly. What are you like? What is an A? Mm-hmm. You know? And it's like, oh my God, really? We're doing this?
Yeah.
Having done some professoring, grappling with people over this, they got an A minus. It's like, for God's sake.
I know. Cause then, I get all kind of bitchy about it. And I'm like, okay, do we really want to talk about what a good student you are? Let's really talk about that. Cause you really didn't get an A minus. You got like a B minus, but you're such a pain in the ass. I gave you an A minus.
Yes. Talk about like blowing the mind of a perfectionist, A minus right? grappler. What? I'm a B minus. No.
Like that's what you actually earned, but okay.
Even in the therapy world, existential therapy is you wandering around the field until you trip over your answers. And whereas there's always been this directive that probably driven by insurance, you know, dollars, we want this done faster. There should be no wandering. You need to just get to the goal. Well, if you just get to the goal, then you miss all these other enriching things that actually make your life healthier in the long run. I'm sure it happens all over the place where quality is thrown out the window because.
Yeah. And just like, did I get my money's worth? Like that's this question all the time that we get, especially, you know, in college, because they are paying for it. And it's like, did I get my money's worth on this? And I'm like, I don't know, because it's not a commodity. I mean, it is now, but it shouldn't be. But I feel guilty about it all the time. Like, did I give them their money's worth?
Some people cannot tolerate that wandering through the field. Like, I know those people are not the right clients for me. They're people who come in and they want very quickly, like, how am I going to fix this problem? How can we work on it? And like, sometimes they'll ease into it. And part of the therapy is helping someone ease into this discomfort of not having an answer. But I've definitely had people over the years who are like, no, I need someone who's going to help me tackle this one behavioral thing and then we're done and I'm done. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm not your gal. That's great. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And I'm the same way as a teacher. The students I have that where we start out the first class they have with me sitting with not knowing and sitting with being uncomfortable, they really dislike it. And then, but by the time they graduate, then I have my students three different times. Like it's fucking awesome. I mean, it's just so like by the third class, those aren't questions. That's just like the way we operate. And, you know, I'm like, remember how much you hated this? And they're like, I know, God.
Oh, Dr. Coach, you and your Jedi mind trick.
Love it.
Yeah. I had this really cool box that I used it was called the Instant Class Kit. And like they were dealing with like indigenous ways of knowing and social justice and like all like it was like posters and all these cool things. But like some of them were these objects. One was like a shell, and the instructions with it were that we would stand in a circle, and then we each take the shell and breathe and whisper into it a name of someone we wish was with us. Mm-hmm. And the first time we did it in the class, like a bunch of people were like, what is this hokey stuff we're doing? And by the time it got around the circle, it was so quiet and so intense. It changed their perspective on almost anything we did the rest of the semester.
Yeah. Yeah. But they had to trust in you.
Sometimes I do have to just say, just do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stop questioning.
Some students aren't going to get it and some are. What I really have like gotten from you today, Kayla, is you are so much about connecting and expanding and like there's movement that's happening there. Your creativity really like lands in thought. It's creative thinking and creative problem solving and creative understanding and creative exploration, which is again, like meta. Kayla is a meta kite.
I love that. Thank you for identifying that. I love that. And thanks for seeing it.
Yeah.
Because right? A lot of times there is that instant question of like, oh, you teach in an art department. What do you make? And I'm like, I make a bunch of stuff. I don't know. I make whatever it answers the question.
You got to rewrite your introduction on your CV, my friend, because now that I've talked to you, I'm like, of course, she's got like 20 pages of all these things she's written, but nowhere does it explain that you teach people to think.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down.
Please do. Your philosophy, like your philosophy on teaching. I'm like, if I saw that, then I would have looked at everything and been like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. Cause that's really all it is. It's like the force of thought. Like where does thought take you? And that's so exciting. Cause then life becomes like a you know where you're going to go. And that's a great thing.
Cool. Thanks so much for coming on. This has been a lot of fun and picking your brain and hearing about all these ideas and how you get people to think. And
yeah, no, this has been so fun. Thank you guys so much. I'm so glad Denise suggested that.
Yes, very, very cool.
Yeah, well, now it's making me think at some point we might need to get Denise on here.
I think all signs are pointing to that.
Yeah. Cool.
All right, y'all.
Cool. Thank you so much, Kayla.
Thank you, guys. See you later.
You take care.
All right. Bye.
So happy to have had such an informative discussion with Kayla Coates, Assistant Professor of Art Education in the School of Art at Arizona State University. The direction of art education training that she spoke of is exciting and has me feeling that much more encouraged about the direction of future art teachers and the kiddos who will be in their charge. We will make sure her links are available in the episode description. Please note, Catherine and I so enjoy bringing you this podcast. We're also so happy when we see similar love reflected back in your following and liking us on the Big Three, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as your positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. All of that goes a long way in helping us keep this podcast going. Furthermore, even the smallest donations of amounts like $1 or $2 a month via our page on www.patreon.com are also the bomb and are essential in keeping this kite in flight. Thanks so much, and here's hoping some others join you. The Kites and Strings website is www.kitesandstrings.com. Email comments and suggestions to kitesandstringspodcast@gmail.com and know that the Kites and Strings theme music is by Harrison Amir. Other original music is by Purple Planet Music at purpleplanet.com. Today's episode was produced and edited by me, Steve Plume, at Turning Stones Counseling, Inc. Be safe.